Hey, the new kid on the block can talk to kids.
I've seen him on so many occasions turn the conversation away from an adult-focused conversation to a student-focused and a child-focused conversation, which is what we're all supposed to be here for anyway.
The expected new Secretary of Education talks the talk for kids in Chicago, but he faces the grown-ups in the Senate today, meeting Arnie Duncan, first day of school, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 13th, and indeed it's a big day for Arnie Duncan. It's a big day for Senate appointee Roland Burris. It's a big day for Senator Hillary Clinton. Big day in Washington.
Yes, indeed. Good morning, Adora.
We'll have a bit of all of those stories, plus the buzz about electric cars. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
Need a quick $350 billion? Just pick up the phone.
I called President Bush to trigger the second half of what's known as the TARP program. That's related to financial rescue.
The second part of the TARP has been approved. President Bush gave the thumbs up, but it will take more than that to get the second half of the $700 billion bailout flowing. That's why President-elect Obama meets with Senate leaders today to make a case for letting the money out officially. But all that money has to get past tough gatekeepers like Republican Senator James Imhoff.
We can't put on fast track the remaining $350 billion in this package. Congress is going to have to actively debate in sending any further funding.
Well, he and other senators are going to have a new colleague, Blagojevich, the appointee from Illinois. The Blagojevich appointee from Illinois, Roland Burris, now has a green light from top Democrats to take his Senate seat. The Illinois leader could take the oath of office this week.
Here's something else interesting in the Senate. In about 90 minutes, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, to be at least Barack Obama hopes, faces her Senate pals for confirmation hearings. We'll tell you what to look for right after the headlines. And in addition to the education secretary hearings we mentioned, President-elect Obama's energy pick will also be on the Hill today. Intense diplomacy goes on behind the scenes, but out in the open, the Gaza fighting rages. Israeli ground troops have made their deepest strikes yet into crowded Gaza City. That's where they expect the fiercest fight from Hamas. We'll get the latest developments from that.
So an eye on oil prices this morning dropped below $37 a barrel. That's way down from $150 last summer. Concerns about global growth. The S&P dropped yesterday. It was down 2.25%. It begins trading at 870 points. And Wall Street is at least looking for a flat to lower opening this morning at 9:30. Detroit is banking on the electric car. And as Adora said, we're going to be talking about the buzz of the electric car. Can it jumpstart the flagging industry? What's the smartest thing they've put into a car? What could the big three invent now to get you back on the road?
I thought a new car could be just like an iPhone. You could dial up whatever engine sounds, whatever mufflers. You could accessorize it, kind of like you do in rock band. A car would become just an entertainment center like any other of the electronic devices.
And you could have a pollution playlist, like a sulfur dioxide, hydrogen sulfide. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org to tell us your invention to get you back on the road. Help the big three out, won't you?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Hillary Clinton's confirmation hearing to be Secretary of State begins today. It's not expected to be a cliffhanger. The outcome is hardly in doubt. But it will be a source of what I like to call a Clinton archaeology, where we will richly be able to delve into all of the sort of details of Bill Clinton's very busy post-presidency and dealing with foreign leaders, the very people that Hillary Clinton will be dealing with as Secretary of State. And, of course, then there's the question of the pre-presidency of Hillary Clinton. Has she given all of that up? Here's Senator Richard Lugar talking about the challenges, at least abstractly speaking, for Hillary Clinton this week.
I don't know how, given all of our ethics standards now, anyone quite measures up to this who has such cosmic ties.
Listen to that, cosmic ties? I didn't thought Bill Clinton's ties were pretty conservative, if you ask me. Gail Sheehy joins us now. She's the author of Hillary's Choices, or Hillary's Choice, a 1999 biography of Hillary Clinton. She, of course, is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and is here in our studio right here in New York. Thanks so much for joining us, Gail.
Hi, John.
This is a fascinating moment. I mean, to explore both the character of Hillary Clinton and also the cosmic ties, as Richard Lugar said on the ABC over the weekend, that Bill Clinton has developed with world leaders all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think we're going to learn?
Well, we're going to learn more about the ties between Bill and Hillary Clinton, which we're always fascinated by. I think she'll be raked over the coals a bit, but I imagine those coals will be pretty lukewarm. And don't forget, this is a woman who faced down a grand jury for 8 hours in testimony during the Star
right.
witch hunt. She knows how to do this.
So what are the sort of hot buttons in terms of Bill Clinton's relationships with people like the president of Ukraine, places in Eastern Europe, his dealings with the Saudis?
Oh, the Saudis, they gave 10 to 25 million along with the – but the Saudis, they sent us 18 or 19 out of 19 hijackers on 9/11, but they always get redacted. You know, their story is always cut out of the Joint Committee report from Congress on the 9/11 report. President number one, Bush president, has taken money for his library from
so
the Saudis.
So everybody's dirty on the Saudi side.
Yeah, I think she gets off on the everybody's dirty on the Saudi
right.
side.
Right, it'll end up in a Michael Moore movie, but probably not going to come up at the hearings.
right.
What about Eastern Europe?
Well, I think, to me, the worst part is the Indian politician who lobbied Senator Clinton only this year on a nuclear cooperation deal between India and the U.S. and got what he wanted, walked away. And that is the closest connection between Senator Clinton and former President Bill Clinton. But
doesn't Senator Kerry have to be a little careful? I mean, the Democrats are in the majority right now. And if the result is inevitable, what do they risk if they push too hard?
It's a very diplomatic situation. I think that Senator Kerry will be very respectful. He's even said in the Times today, "I like her," and he didn't even say she's likable enough.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. They weren't exactly chums in the Senate, and she did. She was quite hostile to his amendment on withdrawal of our troops at a fixed date from Iraq, and said the president needed flexibility to deal with Iraq. So they were really at war during that period.
We should remind people: John Kerry, of course, is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where the confirmation hearings will begin.
Mm-hmm.
So, what does this say about the Clinton relationship? Something you've written on. So much. I mean, are the senators going to demand some kind of bizarre firewall between Bill and Hillary if she's going to be Secretary of State and he continues with his philanthropic and sort of global initiatives?
They can demand it, but you can't do that. I mean, you know, they sleep in the same bed.
Oh, you think so?
Well, they may, but they are on the phone four or five.
Let's make some news here.
Yeah,
okay.
They are on the phone four or five times a day. Always have been, even through the worst of it. And I particularly love the line in the New York Times, extraordinary editorial on this, where they wrote, "There is no perfect solution for Mrs. Clinton's particular spousal dilemma."
Hmm.
And I thought, well, that's about the perfect epigram for Hillary Clinton's entire adult life.
Right, exactly.
But do you think the Obama transition team covered that in the negotiations they had with Bill Clinton prior to nominating Senator Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think they did it, but I would have loved to have heard the negotiations between Hillary and Bill Clinton. Imagine
yeah.
getting him to agree to a 9-point deal where her people in state get to question him on the money he might be wanting to take from some sultan.
Well, I got my wife subpoenaing me now. It's the worst thing I ever
right.
heard. Why'd I get into this thing? Then how's this going to end up? Best guess. Is this going to be a situation where the team of rivals plays more like the Lincoln scenario, or will Hillary Clinton conceivably end up more like Al Haig, a kind of rogue in the Obama administration, doing her own thing?
I don't think she would be allowed to. If she makes an enemy of General Jones or, of any of the other national security people, where there is always friction between the secretaries, of say she would be isolated, but she's not going to do that. She didn't do it in the Senate.
Right.
She surprised everyone by reaching across the aisle to her husband's own antagonists and making common cause with them on many amendments.
And hasn't she done that with members of the Foreign Relations Committee? I believe I read that she's actually reached out to all of them.
Yes, she has. She has. And she knows the generals. She had so many generals behind her in her presidential run saying she would make a marvelous president.
Right.
So she's very, very good at being diplomatic. And she has written, I think, very well about what she thinks her greatest accomplishment will be. And I think it's the role that Obama has chosen her to play, that she can reintroduce America to the world and use soft power to inspire and attract as much as to coerce.
With some clout behind it, in the way that Madeleine Albright never really had the clout, even though she was good with the soft power and was eloquent enough. I mean, Adora has mentioned this a couple of times around the office, that in theory, if we look at this the other way, this could actually be the, you get two for one. The deal that was so sort of joked about during the Clinton presidency, actually in this configuration with Hillary as Secretary of State and Bill Clinton behind the scenes, maybe there's actually a multiplier of power there if it's done right.
Absolutely. This was the first sales point in Bill Clinton's first presidential run. Two for the price of one, and we're really getting it now. And the price will be held down because Hillary Clinton's own people will be scouring the deals that he's making.
So is this a pre-presidency for Hillary Clinton? What do you think?
I think it's the best platform for her next presidential run, and I imagine she'll make it.
You think so?
I think
she Doesn't it depend on now what happens? There's so many variables, and given the dynamics, the geodynamics, the domestic dynamics, who knows what's going to happen?
Well, of course, she's going to have her hands full. I mean, you know, she wrote about how she wanted to really work on a two-state solution for Palestinians and Israelis. Well, it's blown up now to proportions that become more gargantuan every day. So how that all sorts out will very much color her role.
Do you think in the aftermath of this financial catastrophe, which is such a priority in the Obama administration, I mean, he's going to be really preoccupied and evaluated on the basis of bringing the economy around. Does she get off, in a sense, scot-free in her own sort of geopolitical world?
She'll have less oversight from him, I'm sure. But, you know, I think what we have to watch is if she starts traveling right away, that'll be a bad sign because it will mean he's putting her on the road. He doesn't want her around while he forms his basic structure of leadership.
Oh, that's interesting.
Finally, do you expect the Republicans to generate any headlines in these hearings at all? I mean, Richard Lugar sort of suggests that he's skeptical that there can actually be an ethical framework for Bill and Hillary to work together, but I wonder if he's going to stick with that in the actual hearings.
I think that he will be, as always, precise and deep, but careful and diplomatic, because she is. It's just no point in marking up the Secretary of State before we send her out on the road. And I think he's very deeply concerned about our foreign policy role in the world and will want to have her go out with full backing.
Well, that's, of course, Richard Lugar. I mean, there are others in the Senate who maybe aren't quite so restrained.
You
get a Clinton in front of you, and you just never know what's going to happen.
Right. No, I think a couple of them, at least one of them, is a showboater. And it's not a name that we know, so we'll probably want to make news by, you know, hitting her pretty hard.
Any chance Bill Clinton himself is likely to be deliberately tainted by this as a way of inoculating Hillary later on?
That's a good point. I think he may get, more flack than he has in the past, certainly for his post-presidency. But I think he's ready to take it. I think he really feels guilty and furious that his activities denied her, to a large degree, the presidential nomination.
Well, guilty and furious is certainly a prescription for some entertaining sound bites from Bill Clinton over the next several months. Gail Sheehy, thanks so much for joining us. These hearings are definitely something to watch. She's the author of Hillary's Choice, 1999 biography of Hillary Clinton, and contributing editor to Vanity Fair, watching the confirmation hearings in the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate today for Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Thanks, Gail.
Thanks, John.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. One headline this morning is that the Senate has changed its mind when it comes to seating Barack Obama's replacement. From the president-elect on down, we've witnessed rejections turn to embraces. The Senate says it will officially seat the former Illinois Attorney General Roland Burris. Also today, Senator Hillary Clinton will answer questions in her nomination hearing for Secretary of State. Todd Zwillick, reporter from Capital News Connection, joins us from Washington with more. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, Adora.
So a quick turnaround. How is this going to work, and when is Roland Burris going to get his seat?
Well, Democrats say Wednesday or Thursday. That's as specific as they'll get. It depends on schedules, including Dick Cheney's schedule. Vice President has to come and swear Burris in. So whenever everybody can get their schedule sorted and make it over, they'll see Roland Burris. Barack Obama released a statement yesterday evening referring to Burris as the senator-elect. So he's in.
Does this decision make the Democratic leadership look indecisive?
I guess any time politicians change their mind, do a 180, it might make them look a bit indecisive. But I think that's probably secondary in their thinking. They want this off the tables. Next week is the inauguration. They want all attention on Barack Obama and on the new era of Washington Democratic politics. And they don't want this thing hanging around. It's got to be sort of an annoying little issue that threatened to take away not only attention from Barack Obama, but also from the agenda. Don't forget, this is what they call the first 100 days of the new presidency and of a new Congress. They have a big agenda, and they want to try to exercise it without distractions. You know, the stimulus and that whole thing has already wedged its way into the agenda. That's sort of an emergency that has to get done. So they don't need all the smaller distractions and things hanging over it. It's finished.
Not forget, Blagojevich won. Okay, so I mean, yep. He had the Constitution on his side. So
he did. He did. John Blagojevich won, and maybe that's a little bit embarrassing to get beat by somebody in Blagojevich's position, given the fact that of what he's accused of and what Harry Reid said about him. But again, I think the most important thing from their eyes, and Dick Durbin too from Illinois, and Barack Obama from Illinois, and Rahm Emanuel from Illinois.
There was a long list, but clearly it came down to a cost-benefit analysis, and it just wasn't worth it to keep pushing it with so many other very important issues on the table, including, like today, the nomination hearing of Senator Hillary Clinton. Barack Obama needs a Secretary of State, and this is his choice. And who's on that Foreign Relations Committee who's going to be asking her questions today?
Richard Lugar, the minority ranking member, and John Kerry is running the hearing. Let's point out really quickly, the Senate has not reconstituted its committee rules yet. That's one of the first orders of business, but they haven't done it yet. So they're still on 110th Congress committee rules. John Kerry is running this hearing, but technically he's not the chairman. Joe Biden is. Joe Biden's still the chairman of that committee. Now, he's not going to be there. But John Kerry is running the show. There will be some other absences on that committee. Notably, Norm Coleman is on Foreign Relations. He won't be there. He's got a legal fight going on trying to save his Senate seat against Al Franken. Of course, Barack Obama used to be on that committee. He resigned his seat, so he clearly won't be there. And Bob Casey of Pennsylvania and some other members. Republicans apparently have already submitted 170 questions to Hillary Clinton on foreign policy.
170?
What written? That doesn't mean they'll ask them all, but questions on Gaza, the Pakistan-Afghanistan border will be a huge issue. I would imagine that Ukraine and the natural gas situation will come up with Russia. Certainly Gaza, Israel, Egypt, and Jordan, and Iraq, no question about it that those will come up. And then that's all policy and that's all substance. That doesn't mean that they won't delve a little bit into Bill Clinton Foundation, potential conflicts of interest with big donations from Saudi Arabia and other governments and big donors around the world.
It's going to be a very busy hearing. But we know you'll be watching closely, and we'll talk to you soon. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. He's a reporter for Capital News Connection.
Fighting in Gaza continues today, including reports that Palestinian militants have fired with weapons on Israeli forces, and Israeli attacks in Gaza City are continuing. Dozens of homes destroyed as ground troops push in. And former and current generals, Israeli military officials talking to the BBC this morning, suggest that the Israeli military is looking for a decisive military victory in Gaza of some form. We spoke earlier with BBC correspondent Tim Franks in Jerusalem, and I asked him about reports of the intense attacks in Israel and in Gaza in the last 24 hours.
Well, it has been pretty intense. There were 60 airstrikes overnight from Israel on territory inside the Gaza Strip. And also there has been a push by Israeli ground troops on Gaza City itself. They've been launching raids in the southeast and the north into Gaza City. And yes, you're right, face-to-face fighting between Palestinian militants and Israeli soldiers.
So is the military objective clearer at this point, Tim? Is it possible that the Israelis are in some sort of exploratory mode, trying to find weapons caches, perhaps some sort of infrastructure for the bringing in of missiles and destroying those before they actually agree to a ceasefire? Or is it more of a standoff?
No, the Israeli military says that from the air and from the ground, but particularly from the air, it has been targeting what it considers to be the infrastructure of Palestinian militant activity. But I think that the key objective, as far as the Israeli military is concerned, is to try and weaken Hamas, which is the Islamist movement which runs the Gaza Strip, to the point where it will agree to a ceasefire on Israel's conditions. And that essentially is that there be an end to rocket fire into southern Israel and also an end to arms smuggling from Egypt over the southern border of the Gaza Strip. But that is also not going to be entirely dependent on what Hamas agrees to. It's also going to be important what the Egyptians agree to in terms of how strictly they're going to police this southern border. So I think what Israel is doing is certainly on the ground militarily trying to weaken Hamas, but it's also trying to force the diplomatic tempo as well.
I guess finally, I'm sort of astounded at how little Israel seems to be concerned about the potential for a real international backlash with all of the images of carnage and civilian casualties coming out of Gaza. I mean, I think the big story in Israel yesterday had more to do with Joe the plumber being a reporter there. What's your sense of that?
I think there is growing concern about the number of civilian casualties. But there is a feeling in Israel that this is a war that was of Hamas's choosing, not of Israel's choosing. Hamas provoked Israel, along with other Palestinian militants, by firing rockets over the last several years. And there's a feeling of sadness but inevitability among Israelis when you talk to them that if you go to war inside Gaza, because it's such a congested place, civilians are going to get hurt.
And indeed, 900 civilians are believed to be killed in the fighting. Tim Franks, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. We spoke with him earlier this morning.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We noted yesterday that the Detroit Auto Show, which began yesterday, is an important sort of symbolic milestone in the history of the auto industry that's struggling financially right now. But Detroit is banking on new transportation technology, and the financial problems of the auto industry are also a technological problem that all of us have to deal with as we think about how we're going to be driving around in the future. There are actually massage seats in some of the models being premiered in Detroit this week. I hope they can actually slap you awake if you actually might fall asleep on the road there. But what's the smartest thing you've heard that they've put into a car? Is it a GPS? What sort of technology are you interested in? What could the big three invent now to get you back on the road in a new car? An electric car? Maybe a hovercraft? A jetpack? Tell us your stories and suggestions at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Joining us now is Dan Neal, automotive critic, Pulitzer Prize-winning automotive critic from the Los Angeles Times. He's in Detroit covering the show and the industry. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. How are you?
So it's great to talk to you again. And, you know, as I was talking at the top of the hour today, you know, we both grew up at a time when test driving a car was more like experiencing something like this. Oh, yeah. There you go. 427 V8 Chevrolet engine on a 67 Corvette. But actually, if you're road testing Priuses and electric hybrid cars, it's more like this. It's a 5,000-watt hairdryer you plug in the wall. Dan, how has Detroit either preserved or not preserved the sense of electricity in its new car rollouts in the green era? When you go in and test drive some of these new cars, which don't, you know, go from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds.
Well, it's funny because, first of all, the hairdryer is louder than an electric car. And one of the things, one of the unexpected things that car makers have had to deal with when they look at battery electric technology is how to preserve the sense of occasion when you turn on an electric car as compared to a gas-powered car. So the gas-powered car, you've got the key lock and you go to accessory and then you turn it and the engine, starter turns over and the engine starts. With an electric car, it doesn't make any noise. So they've had to create this little graphic interface, you know, that was called a GUI, graphical user interface, that tells you that the car is on. And so there's that moment when it wakes up. And it's important because otherwise people wouldn't know the car is on. And another problem with electric cars, they use regenerative braking, right? So to recharge the battery when it's slowing down or coasting or during hard braking. Well,
regenerative braking means you use the energy from slowing down and that it gets channeled back into the battery.
That's right.
You know,
when you stop a conventional car, you take that kinetic energy and it is converted into heat in the brakes. That's wasted energy. What regenerative braking does is turn the electric motor into a generator by switching polarity, and then that kinetic energy recharges the battery as you coast or slow down. Well, that means that you have something of a different brake feel. It used to be, you know, hydraulic brakes in a regular car. With these kinds of systems, the brake feel is very, very different. So the tactility of an electric car is very different. They've had to be careful not to alienate people who are used to gas-powered cars. Otherwise, they'll think they drive like big golf carts.
Well, you've tried all these. What's the most exciting? What's the most practical? What do you think? You've done the road tests.
Sure. Well, another thing about the electric cars is they have, because electric motors have all the torque down, you know, as soon as they are on, they have tremendous acceleration. They run out of top speed pretty quickly unless you have them geared up properly. But electric cars are very fast in acceleration. So, for example, the Tesla Roadster, which people are excited about in California, it goes from 0 to 60 in about 4 seconds. And it does so with just, you know, kind of this strange humming sound. So the aural qualities are very different. But the nature of batteries is that you can have a lot of power, that is a lot of output, or you can have a lot of energy, that is range, but it's hard to get them both together. So typically electric cars fall on the X and Y axis depending on what the manufacturer wants to do. For example, Mitsubishi iMiEV, it's a little city car that they make in Japan with a fairly small battery. I mean, it won't blow your socks off, but, you know, it'll go for, you know, 100 miles on a charge. And so that's really, it's much more sensitive to their intentions.
That's the macho, goes 100 miles on a charge, more than the, you know, corners really, really well, or, you know, will beat everybody else on the block to the stoplight or something like that, right?
I don't know. I think for example, Dodge is making they want to build a Dodge EV sports car, and that's going to be a super fast car. You can make a fast electric car, and that's no problem. Fisker is a company that's started by Henrik Fisker. His car has got 400 horsepower, electric horsepower, and it's a big, long, exotic electric. No one's driven it yet, but it's going to be, a very aggressive driving car.
And are you confident, before we go, that Detroit's sense of itself from the muscle car era is translatable into the green era of responsibility and not wasting tons of energy?
I think the takeaway, if I may, is that...
go for it, dude.
Is that you can have you can do a lot of things with electric power in cars. Because the components are small, you can move them around in the chassis, so you've got a lot of styling opportunities. You can go fast. You can go far. If you're willing to spend the money, you can do both. Oh, and by the way, before you go, you mentioned cars that wake you up. Mercedes-Benz just unveiled a car that has a drowsiness warning. It monitors the driver's eyelids, and if they flutter or they stop paying attention to the road, it'll a little coffee icon will pop up on the dashboard and tell you to pull off.
No, that's really great. We could use something like that installed right here in the studio. Thanks to Dan Neal, Pulitzer Prize-winning automotive critic for the Los Angeles Times, covering the Detroit Auto Show. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there, John. Good morning. Oh, the time is coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting news in from the Commerce Department about the trade deficit. The deficit has plunged to the lowest level in 5 years. The deficit narrowed to $40.4 billion in November. That was a 28.7% decline from October's deficit of $56.7 billion. In other news, the Fed chief Ben Bernanke says that the president-elect's stimulus package could provide a significant boost for the economy. But he says that it's not all the economy needs and that other steps must be taken to stabilize the shaky financial system. A quick look at your news. I'll be back in 10 minutes with some more.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckendray. And joining us now is Bertrand Benoit from the Financial Times. He's in Berlin, Germany, where the German government has announced, Angela Merkel's coalition government has announced a 50 billion euro stimulus package on top of a 23 billion euro package passed last month. Bertrand, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How important is this stimulus package as a kind of a leader of the European strategy for, pulling its weight in this financial crisis along with Asia and the United States?
It's pretty important. It depends where you're looking at it from. It's important from the German point of view. It's quite a lot bigger than we had expected and than most Germans had expected and experts only 2 weeks ago. For some economists, however, it's not as important as it may seem, and a lot more would be required to prevent what is going to be the biggest recession on record for Germany.
You know, what's interesting is that historically speaking, I mean, Germany, with its unification, has come through what is essentially an enormous
infrastructure stimulus package, financing the construction of Berlin and all of the investment into East Germany. I'm wondering what's left to do.
Well, that's, you know, it's one of the concerns of some of the people who see this package critically at the other end of the spectrum, i.e. as being too big and too generous. You might want to remember that the fiscal stimulus that was associated with reunification, which came almost automatically out of political decisions, created an enormous hangover in the economy. And been here since 2003. The construction sector, for instance, in the whole country, not just in the East, is barely, or was last year, barely starting to recover from the enormous bubble created by this fiscal stimulus back then. So people who are critical of these stimulus, who are more in favor of continued fiscal prudence, would argue that it's going to take a generation to work out the impact of the stimulus on debt, for instance.
So Germany's in a unique position where it historically is inclined to fear a stimulus package as much as it fears a recession. Some economists have argued that with interest rates relatively high in Europe and in Germany, that a stimulus package this big amounts to the spinning of wheels of the German economy. What do you say?
Well, I mean, one of the great hopes that people outside Germany have regarding stimulus is that it will do something that hasn't happened in the upturn in Germany, which is to boost consumer spending. And that's really an area which has, you know, past few months has remained pretty stable, but at a very low level. And so the hope is that we get an inversion of the economic picture in Europe with Germany starting to consume other countries' products in the Eurozone and not just export it to them. I think it's a bit of a long shot, given the cultural differences in the way people approach consumption here, which is a very more cautious manner than, say, in the UK, for instance,
sure,
or the US.
Well, Bertrand, you make an important point that consumer spending has not fallen off the cliff in the Eurozone as it has in the United States. Bertrand Benoit of the Financial Times, thanks so much for joining us, talking about the economic stimulus package announced by the government of Germany. He spoke with us from Berlin.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, January 13th, and Femi Okeh has joined us to bring us up to date on the latest headlines.
Hello there, or good morning. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. This hour, we've had new trade deficit figures from the Commerce Department. The deficit plunges to its lowest level in 5 years as oil imports drop by a record amount. President Bush will award America's highest civilian honor to three of his closest foreign allies today: the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, the former Australian Prime Minister John Howard, and Colombian President Alvaro Uribe will all receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom in Washington. The CDC is urging nursing homes, hospitals, and schools to throw out certain containers of peanut butter. King Nut brand peanut butter is linked to a salmonella outbreak in 43 states. Now, it's not sold in grocery stores, but it is served in large cafeterias and restaurants. Russia's natural gas company says that Ukraine has blocked deliveries of Russian gas to Europe. Russia restarted gas to Europe today after reaching a deal with Ukraine, but EU monitors report that little or no gas is flowing from Russia into Ukraine. And finally, you may be hearing this beautiful overture quite a bit today. It's Verdi's Force of Destiny overture, but also the soundtrack to two very famous French films set in Provence, Jean de Florette and Manon des Sources. The director and producer of those films died this week in Paris, aged 74. Claude Berry was loved by many, many French actors and inspired generations of French filmmakers as well. So that's Claude Berry, dead at 74.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Is there a takeaway question?
Detroit's banking on the electric car, but can it jumpstart their flagging industry?
My name is Steve Batista. I'm calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island. And I think first we need to realize that the energy for those electric cars in most cases comes from a fossil fuel. So we're actually, it's a marketing scam, I think. And then you're left with a dump full of lithium batteries.
So what's your idea? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
An excellent takeaway question. Senator Clinton is not the only nominee to face hearings today. President-elect Obama's selection for Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who heads the Chicago Public School System, will also begin the confirmation process. To help us look deeper into one of his choices is, or one of Obama's choices, I should say, is Veronica Anderson, editor-in-chief of the education magazine Catalyst Chicago. We're also joined by Jess Reyes, a former 7th and 8th grade algebra teacher who worked closely with Arne Duncan at the Chicago Public Schools. Good morning and welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
When you take a look at the numbers, I'm going to start with you, Veronica. Arne Duncan has done extraordinarily well in Chicago. He nearly doubled the number of students who passed reading tests in his 7 years there and almost doubled the number of students who passed the math test, the standard math test. This is what he'll be bringing as education secretary.
Yes, he certainly does that. Does have that to bring to the folks at the hearing. But one thing I'd like to point out about those numbers, while Arne Duncan has certainly done a lot of good in Chicago, when you look at test scores in detail, you can't quite say that they're all the result of the efforts that Arne Duncan and his administration have put in place. First of all, test scores in high school haven't moved all that much. While elementary school test scores have gone up significantly, the biggest gain happened about 2 years ago when the state test was revamped to make it easier to pass. That was in 2006. Since then, scores have gone up 3.6 points. So from 61.6% of children meeting state standards to 65.2% meeting standards.
So you're saying that some of that is misplaced to suggest that it was Arne Duncan's reform-minded leadership that led to those increases.
Right, and I'm not saying that Arne Duncan has not had reform-minded leadership. He certainly has, and he certainly has done some things that have made some improvements. But you can't say that the test scores soared solely on that.
Let's listen. I want both of you to react to something that Arne Duncan said when he accepted the nomination for Education Secretary.
While there are no simple answers, I know from experience that when you focus on basics like reading and math, and when you embrace innovative new approaches, and when you create a professional climate to attract great teachers, you can create great schools.
Jess Reyes, you worked with him, meeting with him once a month for over a year. Give us your experience, and do you think that that statement there accurately reflects how he operates?
Yeah, I do think that that does accurately reflect what he does and how he operates. I mean, he mentions that, you know, that, you know, you focus on the basics, but also at the same time that, you know, you're focusing on, you know, trying new and bold things, you know, to try to attract teachers and to retain teachers. And that was kind of, you know, some of the work that we had done with Arne during that year of the time that I worked with him. We worked on the teacher advisory council to him, and in that advisory council, there was a whole bunch of different issues that were brought up to us that we kind of started brainstorming as a group of Drive Award teachers. And what happened was we got really adamant and got really passionate about teacher retention and teacher quality. And it was something that, you know, we kind of took on and became the form of our work for that year. it ended up becoming something where we were talking about having some type of system in which, you know, teachers would kind of build the quality of teachers, and it would also take a look at how teachers are rewarded in regards to improving their practice, but at the same time, increasing student achievement.
So it sounds as if there was a lot of give and take there. And Veronica, that's been one of the criticisms of Arne Duncan, that he moved too quickly, closed down schools in some neighborhoods that were fine, and then failed to really talk to the people in the community who were affected by those closures.
That's true, although I would not say that the schools in the communities that were closed down were doing fine. They certainly needed something drastic to happen to make them better. And the reasoning behind that initiative that you're referring to, which is called Renaissance 2010, it was aimed to close bad schools and open 100 new ones. The reasoning behind it was to get rid of failing schools, get these children into better ones. But Catalyst found that in those early years, only 2% of the children who were displaced by this initiative found their way into the new schools.
Mm-hmm.
Most landed at schools that were no better than the ones that had been shut down.
So do you think he's going to make a good education secretary?
Well, I actually do. I mean, I think that even though there have been some pie-in-the-sky claims about what Arne Duncan has accomplished in Chicago, I still believe that he has accomplished a lot. I think that his willingness to experiment and try different things to see what works was all aimed in the right direction in classrooms, at improving teaching and learning.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago has one of the shortest school days and the shortest school years, so he has had a big push around extending the school day through after school programs. And he's expressed tempered support for No Child Left Behind.
And obviously that's a very controversial issue.
Exactly.
As part of one of Bush's legacy. Jess, I'm going to give you the last word quickly. Do you think he'll make a good secretary?
I think he will. I mean, just based off of the work that we've done with him, I think that, you know, he's very resourceful and he does seek multiple perspectives that helps inform his decision-making. And I really feel that, you know, that he'll take the advice of others and he'll combine that with,
mm-hmm.
with his own beliefs, and then he'll balance his aggressiveness with his thoughtfulness.
Well, he's certainly hoping all of the senators on the committee today agree with both of you. Veronica Anderson, editor-in-chief of Catalyst Chicago, a magazine that reports on school reform, and Jess Reyes, former 7th and 8th grade algebra teacher, now the Algebra Initiative Coordinator for the Chicago Public Schools. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First day of school for Arne Duncan. And Detroit's banking on the electric car, as we've mentioned, but can it jumpstart the auto industry's flagging fortunes? What could the big three invent now to get you back on the road?
I'm Joel Couch calling from Cambridge. They really need to have like a carbon fiber composite framed car. The car industry in Detroit still doesn't get that lightweight cars is really the important thing. They just think that hybrid's badge on there is the only thing that they have to achieve.
What's your idea? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And your takeaway comes from Tim Franks, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem.
There's a feeling of sadness but inevitability among Israelis when you talk to them that if you go to war inside Gaza, because it's such a congested place, civilians are going to get hurt.
And about half of the more than 900 Palestinians killed in the Gaza fighting have been civilians. We earlier incorrectly stated all were civilians. We're always on. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go.
Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
He wanted to be president.
In 2004, we came so close.
So did she.
Hello, hello, Rapid City. Hello, South Dakota.
He wanted to be Secretary of State.
For 20 years, I've worked on the Foreign Relations Committee of the United States
Senate.
She's
going to be Secretary of State.
I believe the best way to continue serving my country
today in the U.S. Senate.
Like sand through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
On Capitol Hill, they're attempting to confirm a Secretary of State without selling too much soap, dialing down the drama. Not a chance. It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 13th, and it's going to be quite a day on Capitol Hill.
Maybe not as dramatic as Days of Our Lives. Good morning, Adora.
I think everyone's hoping not. Anyhow, good morning. We'll have more than just the drama in the Senate. We'll also have what would Ike think of W? We'll ask Eisenhower's grandson, a historian, about the Bush legacy. All that and more next, but first these headlines.
Diplomats often speak in obscure languages, but the conflict in Gaza triggers simpler words. Here's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
My message is simple, direct, and to the point. The fighting must stop. And to both sides, I say, just stop now. Too many people have died. There has been too much civilian suffering.
And yet the fighting continues. Fierce fighting reported today in Gaza between Hamas and Israel. President-elect Barack Obama meets with top senators today looking for long dollars. He wants them to release the rest of the $700 billion bailout plan. $350 billion is now on hold. The transition team has talked of giving more money to homeowners and small businesses rather than the corporate giants who have gotten much of the funds so far.
The Senate will soon make way for one Roland Burris.
I'm truly humbled and honored to learn that later this week, I will officially be sworn into the United States Senate as the Illinois Junior Senator.
Burris slowly plowed through multiple roadblocks on the way to the Senate. Top Democrats say the Blagojevich pick will soon be sworn in this week. While we're talking about junior senators, Hillary Clinton is on the Hill today for Secretary of State confirmation hearings. Several other cabinet picks have hearings today, including would-be education and energy secretaries. Heavy snow and bitter cold conditions are taking aim straight at the Midwest, parts of Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Iowa, and Minnesota. Expect temperatures as low as 35 below zero. Hundreds of Chicago flights are canceled in anticipation of thick snow.
Oil prices taking a hit this morning. It's dropped below $37 a barrel. The Dow and S&P have both dropped yesterday, and it looks like a lower opening on Wall Street. In about 30 minutes, the S&P begins trading at 870. We're thinking about the Bush legacy. Give us your memorable phrase about the last 8 years.
Yes, I am going to the inauguration with my 15-year-old daughter and my 24-year-old cousin, and we don't have tickets, so we are going. We will be there somewhere way far back, probably sitting in Mr. Lincoln's lap.
Okay, forget the Bush legacy. Look forward to the inauguration. We want your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I believe the best way to continue serving my country is to join President-elect Obama, Vice President-elect Biden, the leaders here, and the dedicated public servants of the State Department on behalf of our nation.
Less than 30 minutes from now, New York Senator Hillary Clinton goes before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for her confirmation hearings. For insight into what we might expect if and when Hillary Clinton takes the reins as Secretary of State, we are joined by Washington Post Group syndicated columnist Marie Coco, who has covered Senator Clinton since she was First Lady in 1993. Good morning and welcome, Marie.
Good morning. How are you today?
Very well. And we're wondering, is this the day that Hillary Clinton says goodbye to her presidential ambitions?
Well, I think that day came when she decided to accept the job, and there's several reasons for that. As you probably know, when you are in the cabinet, you are not allowed to maintain any kind of political committee or organization. You're not allowed to do fundraising. And so her vast organization, which includes, obviously, an organization behind her in New York, but more significantly, HILPAC, which has been her leadership PAC in Washington and which is probably the most extensive database of women in politics, women supporters of hers, men supporters as well. But all of this infrastructure that she would need to mount a presidential campaign in the future effectively has to be disbanded. That's number one. And number two, I think when she took the job, certainly she knew, and I know some of her top aides were very aware of this, you don't go from the cabinet to the presidency. In my memory, in contemporary history, only one person has tried it. That was Elizabeth Dole, the Republican who had been a cabinet secretary twice in Republican administrations, and she made an effort in 2000 to capitalize on that and turn that into a presidential campaign, and she got absolutely nowhere, ended up dropping out of the campaign before the first primary was held. Well, it simply is not a springboard to higher elective office.
And Al Haig tried to run for president after he was Reagan's cabinet secretary, he went nowhere.
Right. Well, one of the things that the most significant thing that happens is that you are no longer your own political player or actor. You don't have your own agenda. You must pursue the agenda of the president. That is diametrically opposed to someone who is trying to stake out ground of his or her own, develop a political persona and a public presence of his or her own in preparation for a presidential run. So I think actually this is not the day she made that decision. The day she made that decision was a couple of months ago when President-elect Obama asked her to take the job and she accepted.
So having covered her for 15 years and observed up close this evolution of Hillary Clinton, how would you describe where you think she is as a person?
Probably this is what she tends to do. She takes the lemons, and as we all know from covering her public career, she's had many thrown at her, and tries to turn them into lemonade. I've never quite seen a politician who is so personally and politically resilient. I think the only parallel I can find is her husband, who, as we all know, has an amazing political resilience. She also is someone, if you've read her book, her autobiography, Living History, that she wrote after she left the White House, she talks about how she has to tune out what she calls the static. I have interviewed her many times, and that's what she calls it, this whole hoopla that the press tries to create about so-called Clinton drama. She actually creates very little drama. It's the press that seems to see drama in everything she does. And I recall very clearly when she first became senator. In fact, she hadn't even taken her oath yet. I'm not quite sure. But the tabloid, you know, Tom Daschle, soon to be Health and Human Services Secretary, then the Senate Democratic leader, was the Democratic leader. And I remember there was a spate of bizarre tabloid stories right before she joined the Senate, somehow linking her romantically to Tom. Actually, she had just joined the Senate. There had been a photograph of her leaning over to him on the dais at a hearing, which, by the way, senators do all the time. That's how they talk to one another. They cup their hand over the microphone and whisper in one another's ears while the hearing is going on. There had been a photograph of her and Tom Daschle doing that, which led to literally a spate of bizarre tabloid stories linking them romantically. And I remember her
totally
telling me...
I totally missed that, Marie. I don't recall that story at all.
I remember her telling me around that time that she had gone to Tom Daschle and said, you know, I'm awfully sorry, welcome to my world. You know, we have something in the Washington Press Corps that has become known as Clinton derangement syndrome, which is every hand gesture is interpreted, reinterpreted, blown out of proportion, and so forth. I don't expect we'll see a whole lot of this today because, frankly, She's going to be extraordinarily well prepared. She's going to be treated with the level of deference that senators tend to use with one another. Mm-hmm. And I think there might be a little bit of the dust up over President Clinton's foundation and fundraising and so forth, but that's frankly about it.
But her sense of drama, if there is one, and taking the media derangement aside for a second, let's assume that's a constant in everything. You know, runs along the lines of the vast right-wing conspiracy, making sort of dramatic kinds of statements about either the world or the state of affairs that then, you know, she has to live with for years later. What is the chance that her view of the world and her statements about world leaders are things she's going to have to live with as Secretary of State?
Well, I don't know how many, I mean, other than her campaign commentary during the presidential campaign, I don't know that she has made controversial statements about world leaders.
Well, for instance, not meeting with Iran, not her sort of being opposed to meeting with Iran. Barack Obama has suggested.
I just have to say, she was not opposed to meeting with Iran. What she was opposed to, this is a very important point, what she opposed during the primary was a presidential level meeting without preparation. In other words, in diplomacy, it is standard practice before you have a démarche like that, what they call a démarche, toward somebody like North Korea or Iran. There is months of groundwork and preliminary meetings.
Well, sometimes there is, sometimes
I mean, by the diplomatic corps and lower level emissaries before you engage the President of the United States and all the prestige.
And there were plenty of high-level meetings during the Cold War, summit to summit, that didn't have that kind of preparation.
That's
that
not
were
true.
Equally
That's,
historic.
No, there was, I was here during the Cold War. Every meeting
Reykjavik?
That the President has, that meeting was planned. What was unplanned is what Reagan did once he got there. There's no question that there was intensive preparation for that summit. Where it all got sort of taken over by the two main players is when Reagan and Gorbachev decided to meet privately without aides. So it isn't accurate that there was,
fair point. I'll take all that. But then what is the suggestion as Hillary Clinton becomes Secretary of State? Is she more likely to engage in a sort of gear up to a fundamentally new relationship with Iran, or more likely to maybe put the brakes on something like that?
She is going to do what President-elect Obama wants to do. He made it clear on Sunday that we are going to have some kind of new approach there. What it is, I think, has not taken shape yet. But I have to tell you, I am not in the camp, and I've known her really for 15 years. She would not have taken this job if her intent was to somehow buck him, challenge him, carve out her own foreign policy. She probably knows better than anyone else because she was in the White House, because, in fact, when she was First Lady, she had a very memorable dispute with her husband's own foreign policy apparatus over the issue of whether she should go to Beijing and make what became that famous speech about human rights.
Mm-hmm.
So she understands full well that there is a foreign policy apparatus, that the president is in charge of it, that it's his foreign policy, not hers. And I am not of the view, again, I'm not a sort of a Clinton conspiracy theorist.
Right.
She did not take this job in order to carve out some grand foreign policy vision of her own.
So you're
with
betting that she's definitely...
With one exception,
okay.
I do believe that she will reinvigorate the work that she had done as First Lady on the issues of women's political and economic development and empowerment.
And we'll be looking for some of those questions today in the hearings. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Marie Coco is a syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group, and she has covered Senator Clinton since 1993.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. This is the last full week of work for President Bush. And so that, of course, leads us to thinking about Bush's legacy. We want you to give us your most memorable phrase that you think represents the last 8 years. And we want you to do it in 8 words or less, representing 1 word for each year. Give us your thoughts about the Bush legacy at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
So you hear the numbers every day, and you talk about $800 billion to fix this, or 40% drop-off in either the price of oil or the value of stocks on Wall Street. The question is, can you analyze what's going to happen day-to-day in the economy anymore in an incremental sense? Or have we fallen off some cliff and have to really redefine our ability to measure what's going on? It's the perfect subject and the perfect moment to talk to Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who's the author of The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable, an enormous bestseller. He's a veteran Wall Street trader and a professor at NYU. Nassim, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
You know, I've been dying to ask you this question for months. At what point does our whole kind of background sense of what's going on have to change for us to navigate a time where so many seemingly improbable things have happened? And in the 6 months, I could tick them off and we'd still be here, 24 hours later of all the improbable things that have happened. How does our basic sense of what's going on have to change?
Well, that's what I say in my Black Swan. My whole idea is that we are incapable of predicting some phenomena. Like, it was very hard to predict that George Bush would nationalize the banks. Only a year ago, someone would have laughed at you if you suggested something remotely like that. So I believe that we should identify situations that can harm us and make sure we're not exposed to them. Instead of foolishly predicting, we should accept that our economic establishment is not up to par in their abilities to predict events, particularly economic events, and that we should not depend on these flimsy predictions.
All right, well, let's talk strategy. I mean, how do we actually end up doing that? I mean, that seems to argue for saying, okay, what is the point at which the entire U.S. capitalist system collapses in the way, say, Russia's did at the end of the Afghan invasion? And there was a period of, 10 years of drunken oligarchs running everything, and then Russia climbed its way out. I mean, is there a scenario like that that the United States should look at and then prepare not to experience?
Well, I mean, people in the military understand very well the situation. They just prepare by making sure that we're robust to some classes of risks, okay? And I think that the capitalistic system is, if we do it right, without too much government mixing and regulators messing things up, because effectively regulators have increased the risks in the past. If we let the capitalistic system work the right way, it will get more robust, because the fragile entities that are not robust to these risks will break, which is why I don't think this is particularly unhealthy, what's happening now. I think that the capitalistic system needs to repair itself from within by breaking what does not work right. And what did not work right, we know now, leverage does not work well in this environment. Some aspects of globalization don't work very well because they increase the risks. And so let the system repair itself. Let the system become robust. People who are incompetent enough to cause this crisis, like Greenspan or Bernanke, all of these people, by not realizing that banks were taking a lot of risk and encouraging them to take a lot of risks, okay, should not be allowed to try to fix the system themselves. We should let the system fix itself.
So you talk about a new normal. As consumers, what indicators should we be looking at to gauge exactly how well we're or not that we're doing?
What I mean by new normal is people, like, I ran into someone on a plane. He said, "Do you think we're going to go back to normal?" And I looked at him and told him, "What do you mean by normal?" He was a billionaire, and well, now much less of a billionaire, ship owner. And for him, normal was the period that we experienced of massive growth financed by debt, but very fragile. And to me, normal is probably what we're going to see. You know, it's like the middle class will do better relatively than the oligarch class. New normal is an environment in which we have much less reliance on debt, much more redundancies, in the sense people have much more cash on the side, much less reliance on stock market returns to finance a retirement, lower growth, but a lot more robust growth.
All right, Nassim, but that's a very alarming prescription. In a sense, you're saying what should have been done here is allow Citigroup to go away, Merrill Lynch to go away, Bank of America to go away, all these banks to go away, and not have the Fed leveraging our stimulus and leveraging our recovery and basically let the cash sit and let the chips fall where they may. Is that what you're really suggesting?
Okay, let me tell you the problem of it's not just this situation. If it were not for government intervention, the bailouts of LTCM, or the bailout of the banks, really, indirectly, in the 90s, when they went bust, we've been bailing out entities, not allowing them to fix themselves. And we got here because the government helped moral hazard. And think about it. You have all these bankers making billions in bonuses cumulatively, and we're bailing them out with taxpayer money. Think of people at Citibank who made cumulatively more than $100 million of bonuses taking hidden risks, and we are now bailing out Citibank. Okay? Do you think that's moral? Do you think that's acceptable? We should not have let the banks get away with bailouts, okay, after their incompetent lending in the 1980s.
Well, and according to the Black Swan, the impact of the highly improbable, we will experience the consequences of that moral hazard being allowed to go on for so long. We're going to have to leave it there. But Nassim Nicholas Taleb, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Nassim Nicholas Taleb is the author of The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable. He's an NYU professor and a veteran Wall Street trader. And now Femi Okeh has headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour and just a few minutes to go before the open on Wall Street. Investors have some new economic numbers to consider. Trade deficits plunged to their lowest level in 5 years as demand for oil dropped by a record amount. It's also just a couple of minutes away before the Senate confirmation hearing for Senator Hillary Clinton. She's the president-elect's choice to be Secretary of State. Her prepared testimony says that the U.S. cannot solve its most pressing problems, and I will quote her here, on our own, and the world cannot solve them without America, end of quote. Indianapolis Colts coach Tony Dungy is hanging up his clipboard. He announced his retirement from football yesterday after 7 seasons with the team. Dungy was the first African-American coach to win a Super Bowl, and he says he wants to spend more time with his family. Has a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Transition officials for President-elect Obama say his administration will issue an executive order on day one closing the prison at Guantanamo Bay. But it may take as long as a year to sort out the fate and legal issues of the 248 prisoners still being held. We're joined now by Vijay Padmanabhan. Until August, he was an attorney advisor in the State Department with responsibility for detainee issues. He's now a professor at Cardozo School of Law. Vijay, thanks for being with us this morning.
Great to be here.
So if President Obama issues that executive order, what will that mean?
Well, I think it's an important statement by the incoming administration that there's going to be a commitment from the top that they're going to move towards closing Guantanamo Bay. But I think people should not assume that's going to happen very quickly. And in fact, his advisors have already come out and said we're talking at least a year or close to a year before all the detainees are going to be emptied out of the facility.
But it certainly starts the motion, and it certainly politically sends a very strong message to those many critics in the international community about what's gone on at Guantanamo Bay.
It does do that. And I think the strongest message that it sends is that unlike the previous administration, which said it would like to close Guantanamo Bay but was unwilling to make any of the difficult political decisions required to do it, that the new administration is going to dedicate all of its resources in the government to actually closing it. And that means taking the security steps that are required to close it, it means taking diplomatic steps to close it.
And let's talk about that long process, something that you were actually intimately involved in at one point. How does that work exactly? There are 248 detainees, some of whom the government has said continue to pose a potential threat. How do you parse through those cases, and what will happen to those who are considered a threat?
Well, I think what you're going to end up seeing is that the administration is going to quickly divide these detainees into two groups. One group is going to be people that the government thinks can be returned safely to their home countries. And with those people, you know, you can begin the process of sending them home rather quickly. Now, the big issue is going to be, what do you do with people who are from countries where there are major human rights problems? And we've already seen that issue with respect to 16 Uyghur detainees who are being held at Guantanamo Bay, who the courts have ordered released and who the government has said we cannot return to China. Where are they going to go? And I think Obama administration officials have been indicating they're hopeful that they're going to be more successful than the outgoing administration in convincing our allies to accept some of these detainees for resettlement. While I think that the new administration obviously has a reservoir of goodwill that the outgoing administration did not have, the truth is that other countries are going to still be reluctant to accept Guantanamo detainees for resettlement.
And what's that argument? What does that sound like when you're talking to a country trying to get them to take one of the detainees?
It's very difficult. I mean, their first question is, why us? You know, they have a parliament, they have a public, and they think that Guantanamo detainees are dangerous, and many of them are. And so they say, as a political matter, why should we be involved in solving your problem?
And what was your answer when you were doing that job?
Well, I think our answer at the time was the United States is doing a lot with respect to the war on terrorism just by detaining these people at Guantanamo Bay and continuing to take responsibility for the most dangerous folks, and that our allies need to step up and share the burden by accepting the least dangerous folks. Frankly, that strategy didn't work. Very few detainees were resettled in third countries. And I think going forward, the new administration needs to think about whether it might not accept a small number of detainees for resettlement into the United States to prime the pump, if you will, and convince other countries they should take the step going forward of letting people into their countries.
Well, perhaps why the argument didn't work is because Guantanamo Bay has become a symbol for the body of international law everywhere as a kind of flagrant violation of human rights. It's not necessarily viewed, as you say, as taking responsibility for the war on terror exclusively. I mean, it's almost like America's Robben Island. I mean, do you think Gitmo in any sense has added to the sense of international law in terms of what nations are allowed to do in their own defense?
Well, I think the Bush administration's biggest mistake with respect to Guantanamo Bay was treating it as a legal black hole, as something aside from the laws of war. I mean, nevertheless, the truth is that there are some very dangerous people that are detained at Guantanamo Bay. I mean, I think everyone's security benefits, for example, by having Khalid Sheikh Mohammed detained.
Well, he could be in a federal prison. He could be at, Pelican Bay, couldn't he?
He could be, but that, of course, leads to the second question, which is once you've sorted out the people who you want to release, where are you going to prosecute the people you want to prosecute?
And have they figured that out?
The new administration is not. The outgoing administration's view has been that it's very difficult to prosecute some of these people in the federal courts, partly because the evidence they have against them was not obtained through traditional police work.
So it's just very difficult. That premise by itself is very difficult to believe, given the fact there have been so many cases that federal judges have said you have to release these detainees. You don't have the evidence to hold them for any reason. And that's happened repeatedly.
It has happened repeatedly, but nevertheless, you know, I think one of the problems is you have about 250 people that are detained at Guantanamo Bay. And I think the population of people you would call very dangerous is probably one-fifth of that population, you know, somewhere in the 30 to 50 person range. And so with those 30 to 50 people, the new administration's going to have to find some avenue to prosecute them or some other alternative to detain them.
That's Vijay Padmanabhan. Thank you very much. He's a former attorney advisor in the State Department with responsibility for detainees' issues. He's now a professor at Cardozo School of Law. And now we have some headlines from Femi Oke.
And the time is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. The Senate confirmation hearing for Senator Hillary Clinton just began a few moments ago. John Kerry began the introductory speech. And let's just listen into it a little bit that we taped for you just a moment or two ago.
I think every member of the committee believes very strongly that in Senator Clinton we have a nominee who is extraordinarily capable and smart, an individual with the global stature and influence to help shape events.
That is John Kerry talking about Hillary Clinton. She's the president-elect's choice to be Secretary of State. Her confirmation hearing for that position is going on right now. And Hillary Clinton actually said in her prepared testimony that the U.S. cannot solve its most pressing problems by itself and the world cannot solve them without the United States. Fed Chief Ben Bernanke is in London speaking in support of a stimulus package. He says it could provide a significant boost for the economy, but he says it's not all the economy needs.
Fiscal actions are unlikely to promote a lasting recovery unless they are accompanied by strong measures to further stabilize and strengthen the financial system. History demonstrates conclusively that a modern economy cannot grow if its financial system is not operating effectively.
Bernanke says how governments respond to the crisis will determine the timing and strength of economic recovery. Israel's military chief says the offensive against Hamas must continue. He praised the troops' accomplishments so far, but says there is much more to be done. As both sides continue the fight on the ground, international efforts for a ceasefire continue. Vice President-elect Joe Biden is in Iraq for meetings with the Prime Minister of Iraq and other leaders. An Iraqi spokesman says that Biden told him that any troop pullout moves will be done responsibly so as not to threaten security gains. And that's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And yesterday, it was a no-brainer and a really lucky man. Two people inducted into the Hall of Fame, the Baseball Hall of Fame. Ricky Henderson, of course, the man who's stolen more bases than any human being ever will and ever has. And Jim Rice, who might better be described as the lucky man. Jim Rice, of course, from the Boston Red Sox. Joining us to talk about all this, Jeff Beresford Howe, Takeaway Sports commentator, joins us from Oakland. Jeff, thanks for being a part of the program.
Good morning.
So, you know, this is a great moment for Jim Rice, and I could never figure out why he was overlooked for so long. This was his last chance to get in, and now he's in.
I can tell you why he was overlooked so long. The man was a terrible fielder, a bad base runner, a low average hitter, and a low on base percentage guy.
He aside from that,
you know, the thing about Jim Rice is if he had played his career in Kansas City or Minnesota, he would have had 0% chance to make the Hall of Fame. He was a Boston guy for his whole career, and that made all the difference for him.
Yeah, all right. Well, I take your point. Ricky Henderson, though, he's got the stats. There's not a lot of controversy there.
Ricky Henderson is, I'm not sure people completely understand how great Ricky Henderson was. He was one of the 10 best players who ever lived. He's a Ted Williams, Willie Mays level kind of guy.
And explain how he could advance the base runner and turn a single into a run like nobody else.
Ricky Henderson was on base all the time. As soon as he got on base, he became the entire focus of the action. Every pitcher, every fielder was more aware of Ricky than they were even of the hitter. For years in baseball, the best place to be in baseball was at the plate while Ricky Henderson was on first base. A whole group of guys had their best career years with Ricky Henderson on first base in front of them.
Although he also produced more errors of pitchers trying to throw to first and get him out, or throw to second and get him out, or double plays that just went awry.
and more of everything. Ricky, there's never been a player like Ricky in the whole history of baseball. Power, speed, defense, and a concentration and a focus that was beyond comprehension. I mean, there's just never been a guy who could do it like Ricky did.
Yeah, and he has a curious relationship with himself. He seems to know himself pretty well. He only speaks of himself in the third person.
Yes, well, you know, famously, Ricky once called the general manager of the San Diego Padres. He was looking for a job, and apparently he picked up the phone and said, "Hi, this is Ricky. I'm representing Ricky, and Ricky would like to play."
Ricky didn't, you know, play by the rules except on the field.
Ricky was the most intense competitor I ever saw. I was lucky enough to see him a couple hundred times, and there has never been a player that I've seen who could be more focused on the game and more intense about every single moment of the game than Ricky Henderson off the field. The man is crazy. I mean, he's
love that.
He's love that. He drove people crazy off the field.
Before we go, there were some stats in the Hall of Fame voting that suggest that the steroid scandal is something that's going to persist for the rest of the decade. Explain quickly how that went.
Yeah, Mark McGuire's vote went down a couple of percentage points. People have been assuming that McGuire's support would gradually build as people forgave the steroids era, and that does not appear to be what's happening. And if I'm Barry Bonds, I'm definitely not making any reservations for Cooperstown in the next 5 or 6 years.
Or Roger Clemens. Jeff Beresford.
Or Roger Clemens. Yeah,
exactly. Jeff Beresford, Howard Takeaway Sports commentator, talking about Ricky Henderson into the Hall of Fame, and Jim Rice, you know, go figure, is also in the Hall of Fame. I'll take it, though. Thanks, Jeff.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 13th. Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Good morning. The time is 30 minutes to the top of the hour. Right now, Hillary Clinton is in the Senate testifying in confirmation hearings for Secretary of State. She's widely predicted to win confirmation, but not before tough questions on her husband's post-presidential business dealings. If you want to follow along with that hearing, you can do that on thetakeaway.org. Look at the homepage, go to the bottom on the right-hand side. I couldn't find it, but I'm sure you will be able to.
Of course you found it, and it was great.
It was
extremely
excellent.
High resolution. Yes,
yes, email me when you find it. Also on Capitol Hill today, President-elect Barack Obama meets with top senators in a quest for big money. He wants them to release the rest of the $700 billion bailout plan. Some $350 billion is now on hold. The transition team has talked of giving more money to homeowners and small business rather than the corporate giants who have gotten much of the funds so far. Heavy snow and bitterly cold conditions are taking aim at the Midwest. Parts of Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Iowa and Minnesota expect temperatures as low as 35 degrees below zero. And hundreds of flights into Chicago are cancelled in anticipation of the thick snow. And in sports, the former Florida State football safety Myron Rolle says he's going to Oxford, England as a Rhodes Scholar instead of entering this year's NFL draft. Rolle was considered a very strong prospect. Rolle says he'll be back for the 2010 draft. That's a look at some of the news making news this morning.
Thank you very much, Femi. So we're thinking of the Bush legacy, just like George W. Bush is. You may have heard his news conference yesterday saying goodbye to the press. He's planning to say goodbye to the nation on Thursday. Give us your memorable phrase to remember the last 8 years in 8 words or less.
My name is Shakuntala. I'm calling from Corona, Queens. And I want to say that what I will remember of George Bush is you're doing a great job, Georgie.
You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your take or my take at thetakeaway.org. At these sorts of moments, at the end of a presidency, when an entire era is changing, there's a real changing of the guards, and there can be moments of real serious candor, like in this moment.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
President Dwight David Eisenhower, in his farewell speech in 1961, used an occasion to say goodbye to the country to issue a series of warnings that have resonated down through history. President Bush will be giving a speech on Thursday that has been touted as a goodbye to America speech after 8 years in the presidency, anticipating the inauguration of Barack Obama. What will he say? We've asked David Eisenhower, director of the Institute of Public Service at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, to join us to talk about the sort of final moment of the Bush legacy and what that maybe bodes for the post-presidency of President George W. Bush. David Eisenhower, thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning.
How do you, you know, when I saw on the wires that President Bush was giving a goodbye to America speech on Thursday, I immediately thought of your father's military-industrial complex speech. Do you think there's any relationship, or am I just, you know, off in the clouds somewhere?
Well, you know, I think you said it as I was waiting to come on the show. There is a changing of the guard going on here. And that in 1961 brought forth a very memorable farewell address. The announcement that I heard yesterday took me by surprise because President Bush had indicated in December, I believe, that he was not going to give a farewell address. Hmm. And that would have been more in keeping with recent practice. It's been a while since we've had a memorable farewell. Maybe as a result of the response to yesterday morning's press conference or something, he reconsidered. It's now January also, meaning we're a week or so away from the big day, and Washington certainly reflects that. There's probably construction all over the official quarter of that city, which is a reminder of the great parade that is going to happen in about a week. And all of these things probably converge to remind the president or to dramatize that this genuinely is a changing of the guard. And so this may occasion a very memorable statement on the part of the president.
He may have something to get off his chest. Looking forward to the post-presidency of George W. Bush, what do you think the precedents are for his history and legacy as he goes forward? I'm drawn to the Carter moment when he left office. I don't know if it's the same for you.
Well, I think that what presidents have proven since 1945 is that to a degree they do not cease being president. Every president that we've had in our history represents something slightly different about America, and they continue to represent that out of office. And it's very unusual for an individual actually to retire after the presidency. My grandfather, being a case in point, he officially retired. In fact, took his Army rank back. Historians say, and I agree, that his most effective years as a partisan, that is, as a Republican working for his party, were really 1961 through about 67. These were his years out of office. And I would anticipate that President Bush will continue to be a powerful figure, very powerful figure in the Republican Party. He will not be, I would say, a sort of national unifying figure in the way former president can be, and in fact, the way Dwight Eisenhower was in the late 60s. I do not doubt that George W. Bush is a very popular politician, particularly in Texas, Florida, and what we call the Bay States today.
Well, there's certainly one legacy that he's managed to hold on to through these 8 years, and that's his ability to fundraise. Even the past election cycle, we saw that he raised good amounts of money for the Republican Party.
Well, that's right. And another symptom, we remember in what was the second or third debate in the presidential campaign when when Senator McCain said, you know, if you wanted to run against George Bush, you should have run 4 years ago and so forth. That was a startling comment because for practically 12 months, a huge field of Republican candidates had run for the nomination. And what they declined to do was to really make an issue with the president. I was struck by how, disciplined or polite the presidents were, or the presidential candidates on the Republican side were throughout 2008. And I think that, again, that's testimony to President Bush's ongoing strength in the Republican Party, which is certainly a project he will carry over into the post-presidency. I don't doubt that.
You know, Dwight Eisenhower, the nation had much more interest in his war years and what he would write about his war years than they did ultimately in his presidential years. Mm-hmm. What do you think the question is that Americans need answered from George W. Bush if he should write a memoir?
Actually, he has a real opportunity, it seems to me, in writing a memoir, because so much of the story of the past 6 or 7 years cannot or has not been told. You know, one of the things that struck me about this press conference yesterday is that he kept referring back and forth in friendly exchanges with journalists how much they had gone through together. Well, you know, if you sit down and actually mark off the events of this presidency, there are very few hundred days, five weeks in World War II are more eventful than most of the international episodes. But you get the feeling, watching President Bush, that, in fact, a great deal did happen.
And there's a great deal to think about as he goes back to Crawford to contemplate what the next
exactly.
step is.
And I think that is a story, in fact, that has been largely hidden from public view that he can tell in a memoir. I think he has a great opportunity in that.
So, David Eisenhower, thanks so much for joining us. He's the director of the Institute for Public Service at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania.
And so I wake up in Crawford Wednesday morning, and I suspect I'll make Laura coffee and, you know, go get it for her. And it's going to be a different feeling. And I just kind of, I'll report back after I feel it.
That's a vision. That is certainly a vision. President Bush giving his wife Laura coffee. And of course, we're wondering, what's your vision of Bush's legacy? What are your 8 words to break it down, what he's meant the last 8 years?
I'm calling from Baltimore, Maryland. My name is Ruben, and I will be attending the inauguration. One of the interesting things about it, though, is that we have a hotel room, and we've just found out that everything is sold out, so we are actually planning on selling our hotel rooms for the highest bidder on eBay.
Well, there's some people who are thinking about the next president to come, and if you're one of those people, we want to hear your story if you're going to the inauguration. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
You are no longer your own political player or actor. You don't have your own agenda. You must pursue the agenda of the president.
That's Marie Coco talking about Secretary of State-to-be Hillary Clinton. Her confirmation hearings just began. I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.